You may remember the childhood saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But when it comes to adolescents being bullied, it turns out that besides the physical and emotional damage that can happen, it can actually change their brain development. And that's news, because while very young brains are known to be easily altered, it wasn't previously known that adolescent brains were this susceptible. Our next guest says we have more information than ever before to help people recover from that and other types of trauma, and to encourage different systems to work together to support kids and adults who have been bullied. Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Nafzaria, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Before we get into this new research, can you talk about bullying in general? How do we define it? What behaviors constitute bullying?
That's sometimes tricky to define, but honestly, bullying is any behavior where someone is trying to intimidate someone else. And usually we're referring to a child, although, of course, it happens in the adult world as well. It's intimidation, intent to create fear. You know, it's really more about power than anything else.
Now, prior to this brain research, what do we know about the impacts, maybe long-term impacts of bullying on kids?
I think we've known for a long time that, you know, kids can become chronically fearful, anxious, you know, all those sorts of things that we typically associate with bullying. It might even lead them to even have physical symptoms, stomach aches, headaches, avoid situations in which they might be bullied. And of course, this can have lifelong consequences.
Now, here comes this brain research that says it's not just those things we see on the surface. This may actually affect brain development. What kind of things are we seeing here?
What we're seeing is that some parts of the brain seem to differ in terms of their size. So parts of the brain that are associated with pro-social behavior, learning, curiosity, willingness to experience new situations seem to actually be smaller or not as well developed. And the parts that are about fear, self-defense, worry, self-preservation, all those sorts of things seem to be larger or more active.
In people who have been bullied over a long term.
Yes.
This doesn't seem like it should be too surprising. I've heard you talk here on the show and elsewhere about the impacts of trauma in general on brain development.
Yeah, what's really interesting about this study is that we've known a lot of this over the last, say, 15 to 20 years in terms of brain scans and research in young children, right, in the 0 to 5. And I think we've always had this assumption that, well, you know, young brains, they're so malleable. Of course, we're going to see these brain changes. What's different with this is that it's showing similar types of brain changes, except it's showing them in adolescence. And this is actually what's fascinating, is that we think of the infant brain as being, you know, as I said, malleable and able to change and adapt and all that stuff. And we think that it's not so much after, say, age 5. But there's a second period of malleability, and that's in adolescence. Their brains are actually doing a whole bunch of neurological reorganization. And this is why also adolescents do the things they do, the parts of their brains that make have them think about consequences and so on. Don't connect as well to the rest of the brain until their early 20s. And this is why you see impulsive behaviors in many, not all adolescents, but in many. And we consider this to be normal because it is.
But if we see these impacts on the size of different parts of the brain for adolescents who have been bullied, does that in turn mean they are going to behave differently? Or are we going to see consequences of these changes in their brains?
Well, I think that the thing is, this is simply showing us a measurable physical correlate of what psychology has been telling us for decades, right? So I don't think there's anything new that we're really getting from this study that says this changes how we handle bullying and X, Y, and Z. I think what this does is it adds an added impetus to say we need systems, schools, clubs, you know, all those sorts of social settings, and families have a responsibility, an added responsibility to say, we really need to make sure we're nipping bullying in the bud and make sure that we're not inadvertently creating environments that allow that. And also, it maybe gives us something where we can say, if we get the person who's being bullied the right kind of help and the right kinds of therapies, could we, in a research setting, actually measure whether the brain changes are being reversed?
there is, I think, sometimes an attitude where, well, bullying is just a fact of life. It's a part of growing up, a rite of passage, maybe, and it leads people to dismiss the potentially serious impacts. Do you think we're starting to get past that way of thinking?
I think we're long past that way of thinking in many settings. I'm not saying that there aren't still people with attitudes like that, but because numerous times I've said to parents whose children are being bullied in the exam room, I've said, you know, the school has a responsibility to provide a safe environment. I wrote a piece for the American Academy of Pediatrics parent portal, healthychildren.org, about bullying on school buses. Those are also an extension of the school environment, and they have a responsibility to provide a safe environment. So we're actually taking, I think classically we've put the responsibility on the person being bullied, the bully, and maybe their parents, and sort of sort it out. And then you're asking non-experts to figure out how to sort out these uncomfortable situations. I mean, if my child was bullying someone, I would not really know how to discuss that well with another parent in a productive manner. It's the systems and places that have the responsibility to create that, to handle it, and to have policies and procedures in place that everyone feels safe, invited, and welcome.
Talking to Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria about the long-term potential impacts of bullying and other trauma, how it affects kids and their brains. Now, you mentioned earlier the idea of, okay, can we provide treatments, bully recovery, and can we measure it in their brains? What do we know for kids who have dealt with trauma at whatever age? Are they doomed forever, or are there things we can do to help mediate that damage?
The brain is always malleable. Okay, the greatest ability to change the brain is young, right? So if a child is having issues at age one or two, exposures to violence, trauma, et cetera, the sooner we can get to that, the far better, far easier it's going to be long term. Having said that, you could hand me a 50-year-old, well, not me, I'm a pediatrician, but you could hand someone a 50-year-old and say, this person has had all this trauma, help them, and that's possible. It's the brain can always be changed. It's just much harder the older you get. So it's not that this is a death sentence, so to speak. It's not that this is inevitable. What we're saying, though, is that we can show that these correlates, and it, by the way, it's not just brain scans. There's also excellent studies about looking at cortisol levels. Cortisol is the hormone that is released in response to stressful circumstances, and there's really fascinating work being done with cortisol assays. Again, as some sort of way to track or measure what's happened and are there indices that tell us things are improving. Of course, the most important index of all of this is how is the person themselves doing? And asking them, let's not just focus on brain scans and cortisol assays. How are you actually doing it, person that we're trying to help?
It seems like there's almost a quiet revolution going on that's connecting healthcare and schools and social work and a number of other fields, bringing in ideas like trauma-informed care, adverse childhood experiences and the impact those can have on kids and then on grown-ups. Are we going through a big change in how we look at people and the connection between our life experiences and our physical and mental health?
I think that's absolutely correct. We're starting to recognize that these silos we've traditionally had, healthcare over here, social services over here, education over here, it shouldn't be about those silos, right? It should be about children. It should be about their families around them and about their well-being and not these individual places. What hasn't kept up with the science and the state of the art are the structures we have for all of these folks to work together. I've frequently pointed out that, for example, for me, if I'm in primary care, to take 2 hours out of my morning to go to a school to attend an individualized education plan meeting, well, that's lost revenue for the system when I'm not seeing patients, even though the right thing to do may be to be at that visit because they really need my input. So the systems that we have for payment, for privacy laws, for exchange of information, all these things are still sitting probably a few decades behind what the state of art is telling us we should do. So then the challenge is trying to navigate the headwinds of all that structure. There's changes being made, but sometimes I feel not fast enough.
How do we get there from here to have it so that the teachers and doctors are working together, the social workers and parents are working together, whatever, that everybody who needs to be at the table can be at the table, whatever their job might be?
There needs to be an intentionality about it to say we need a few key individuals to sit down and to actually say this is our goal and how do we get there without putting too much of a focus on individual budgets, needs, systems, et cetera, and then say, how do we get there? So, for example, there can be agreements signed to help with exchange of information, of course, with the parents and family's consent mm-hmm. and all that. There can be ways to say, we're going to free up someone's time so that they can provide the medical input to the school or whoever needs to be there. But there has to be kind of an organized strategy to go there. And again, this happens in small places. I just think we can reduce the activation energy, so to speak, by changing some of our rules and expectations so that people are kind of forced to go there and it's not just the cutting edge folks who are going to do it no matter what.
Zooming back in on bullying in particular, as we wrap up, what are the next steps? What are the things we still don't know that would help us?
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest challenges are often initial identification. Right? Kids do not want to reveal that they're being bullied. They will hide it. They're afraid they will get into trouble or that there'll be repercussions for this. This is true of adults as well. Our society is having major conversations about what happens to people who call out behavior that they're seeing in front of them that they think shouldn't be happening. All of these are challenges, so we need to create those safe spaces. We need to make sure that we take people seriously, and we need to make sure that they're hearing clear messages that this wasn't their fault and that what happened to them is not right. And then also to investigate, why is the bullying happening in the first place, right? Bullies themselves often have been or are being bullied on their side. Treating them as someone who also needs help is really important, and not just demonizing them. And then ultimately, we can actually think about not just apologies, not just forgiveness, but also really the concept of atonement, of how do we make things right.
Dr. Navzaria, thanks a lot for joining us again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Dipesh Navzaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He's with us to talk about new research that shows that being bullied can actually change the brain structure of adolescents and what that means for intervention and treatment.